there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, host of an hour of medical debate, discussion, dialogue, answers to your questions via phone or email, all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. I also want to remind you that you can check on the website, askdrdawn.com, and listen to previous shows, archived interviews, and also find resources and references relating to this program. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I wanted to start off by stepping up onto my soapbox. A minor headline that died quickly this week in the news was that First Lady Michelle Obama and Walmart have worked together to do something that really represents a fairly fundamental shift, I think, for Walmart. They are going to reformulate thousands of store brand products to reduce sodium and sugar. And more importantly, they're going to push their suppliers to do the same thing. Now, this is important because Walmart actually accounts for 15% of the grocery industry all by itself. They can be an influential force in re-engineering the food supply. And that's really the theme of my soapbox comments today. We need to take back social engineering. For the last 20 years, the only people who've been doing any social engineering are corporations and their marketing departments. And they've been doing an excellent job at completely shifting the values and reflexes of the American people. We've been supersized and we've been pharmacized, and we need to push back and do a little reverse social engineering of our own. A good example of that is an announcement from the Surgeon General's office stating that the new healthcare law requires employers to start offering reasonable break times for women to pump breast milk and a private place, not a bathroom, in which to do it. 3/4 of U.S. women breastfeed during the first days of a baby's life, but by the time you get out to 6 months, the number of babies who are getting the breast milk as their only food has dropped to 13%. And that's because our society and our culture do not facilitate breastfeeding. This in spite of overwhelming scientific evidence that breastfeeding is good, that it reduces ear infections and thus antibiotic use in the first year of life, that it reduces the chances that babies will develop all sorts of infections, and that it reduces the mother's risk of osteoporosis, reducing it, I might add, for the rest of her natural life, and her risk of breast cancer. So with all of those goods, why can't we see more breastfeeding? Well, the reason is because we have productivity as our God and our only God, because that's what corporations do. And as long as businesses are allowed to work in the free market without restrictions or without obligations being enforced by a government, one would hope a beneficent government with some regulations that support things that are socially valuable, like breastfeeding, we're not going to see those courtesies being offered by employers. It took the American with Disabilities Act to force employers to put ramps in and to create disability-friendly bathrooms. And I have to say, sometimes these regulations go too far and are too onerous. But there's a happy medium in there. So I want to call sort of globally, let's take back our social engineering. Let's do a little bit of social engineering for public health, and bravo to Michelle Obama for her efforts in reducing childhood obesity, one of the greatest looming public health problems on the event horizon for the next 20 or 30 years in this country. First, some emails. This one from an anonymous woman who says, please don't use my name. Concerning the doctor's comments on HPV virus on last Saturday's show, I'd like to add my experience. I was infected myself during an extremely short relationship in which we were excessively careful with condom use. Fortunately, my immunity fought off the human papillomavirus successfully, but the experience left me very scared and frustrated because I was so careful. And if you cannot test a man and condom use doesn't prevent it, what's a woman to do? As to the question of blaming the man, well, no, that may not be fair. But to me, it was an insult on top of injury, since he treated me as though I were dirty when I had my period and then literally walked out on me for no apparent reason and was completely unreachable by the time I was diagnosed. Feel free to share my story, but no names, please. This is a really small town. Thank you for your show. I love your common sense. Well, thank you very much. And I am sorry that you had a bad relationship. But I think your comments do speak to, well, something that we have to be a little bit nihilistic or fatalistic about, more accurately. And that is that there really is no way to prevent the spread of HPV. If you're going to have sex, you are potentially going to be exposed. That's the state of the situation. Fortunately, there are a lot of different kinds of HPV. The high-risk ones that we have vaccinations for can be addressed. The medium-risk ones, which do associate with some cervical cancers, are not currently addressed by the vaccine. So it's going to be like it is with the antibiotics. We'll fight back the worst offenders and then reduce the presence in the population of the HPV 16 and 18. And partly that will be because we vaccinate a whole cohort of young women who then do not spread the disease to young men, who then do not spread the disease to other young women. And it is more easily spread through heterosexual contact, but it is also spread through homosexual, gay, or lesbian contact. So there really is no way to escape this beyond celibacy. On the other hand, you don't have to be completely, tripped out, but thinking that you've got some kind of social disease. Like I said, if 30% of the population show evidence of infection, it's so common that it should lose all stigma and just become one of those things that we have to deal with when it occurs, like the common cold. And just a quick note to Bonnie in Plattsburgh, New York. Bonnie, you have a problem with your anosmia and you got some IgG food allergy testing. So you stopped the foods you were allergic to. That's a great first step. But you said something in your note, for the last 21 days, I have not had sugar other than agave nectar. Honey, I got to tell you something. Agave nectar is sugar. It is a sweetener. It is mildly more nutritious, perhaps, than table sugar. But it's not going to be safe for diabetics, and it's not going to be a way to not fuel any yeast infection that you might have going in your body if you believe that starch fuels yeast. Now, the good news is that you're on the right track. I would try a gluten, soy, and corn-free diet for another 2 or 3 weeks just to see if that improves your sense of smell. And I also wanted to emphasize the importance of oral zinc supplements and the avoidance of zinc nasal sprays, because the zinc sprays have been shown to reduce the sense of smell in individuals, and so they need to be avoided. This email for Marine in Pacific Grove. Pertussis epidemic, why is no one talking about it? Since early December, I've been coping with the nasty bouts of coughing, and when I checked my symptoms, not typical of bronchitis or pneumonia online, I realized I might have pertussis. When I made my appointment with the doctor, I told the reception I had a cough, but didn't mention my self-diagnosis. The doc was way ahead of me. She was swathed in protective gear with an awesome face mask when she came into the examining room. Really? Wow. Now it's almost February, and while the azithromycin pretty much knocked out the worst of it, the cough recurs from time to time. But I'm terribly concerned that I and others might be contagious long after the initial symptoms came and went. Actually, if you've had the azithromycin, you aren't, by the way. Recently, I heard a memorial for a one-year-old child in Monterey who died of pertussis. She went to bed with sniffles and was dead in the morning. I've heard about immunization campaigns for school-aged children, but nothing more about this awful disease which kills infants. What gives? Why isn't this topic number one on your program and others? I would appreciate information about it, about how I, an older adult who has had this bug, should proceed. But even more important, I hope you will get the word out to the community on your program. This should not be happening. Thanks for your great work. We love your show. Well, Maureen, once upon a time, there was a campaign in Japan because there are a number of children who will have neurologic damage as a result of the pertussis vaccine that was then available. That type of damage, I might add, is turning out to be much less frequent with the newer acellular pertussis vaccines, and I'll come back to that in a minute. However, at the time, the Japanese government decided to stop vaccinating children, and they had had 5 Japanese children with neurologic damage the year before. The year they stopped vaccinating children, they had over 100 children dead from pertussis. Pertussis or whooping cough kills infants because they have a small narrow airway and the swelling is enough to literally cause them to suffocate. This can happen very rapidly and indeed overnight is a possibility. In older people, the airway damage is still significant and they can cough for months, and that I expect is your situation. As we age, our pertussis immunity, which we get from our childhood vaccinations, is reduced. Nowadays, we have a new type of pertussis vaccine, which is safe to give to adults. Previously, the vaccine was too potent and adults would get sick from it. Now, that's not occurring, and I urge all adults to get revaccinated at the next time that they boost their tetanus. They should also get an adult pertussis vaccine, which is now being packaged with tetanus and diphtheria. So it's a nice booster shot. I've been encouraging people to do this. Whenever I have to redo a tetanus, I'm always trying to get people to take that vaccine. I did talk about the pertussis vaccine. It goes back several months when it first started, and we did do an announcement about it then. Sorry, I haven't felt that the topic, given all the other things there are to talk about, needed hammering in, essentially. However, I do accept that perhaps I should have talked about it more this last year. So hope that's helpful, and I hope that the information that I've just given will help someone else avoid pertussis. Let's go to Jake in Monterey. Hello, Jake, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm good.
I saw crossed my path Morgellons disease about 4 or 5 years ago. And at the time, people had theories about chemtrails and all of that. I don't want to get into that. But recently, you guys had a program on KUSP, and somebody called in regarding Morgellons disease and said that they did some research, and it looked like it's connected possibly to GMO foods and particularly GMO corn. And I just want to know if you have any information about, I mean, the Morgellons in itself is pretty scary when you look at some of the stuff that's out there.
Oh, God. Do not go online and read the Morgellons stuff, folks. I mean, it's toxic memes. A meme is an idea that gets into your head and haunts you. Like, you know, I won't hum one of those meme rock songs that will haunt my entire audience for the next day, but we all know what they are, right? So toxic memes to be avoided, and Morgellons is a toxic meme. It will get into your head, you will start scratching, you will start pulling your hairs out and discovering that things extrude from your skin. So what is Morgellons? Some people have dermatitis and itching, and they have this black material that they pull out of their skin, and they're convinced that it's an organism, an entity. And the problem is that if you take normal skin that isn't diseased and you pick at it and you scratch at it and you squeeze it, it starts to mutate and change on you because it's reacting to that abnormal stimulation and seeking to protect itself and heal. And you will get hemoglobin being released when you squeeze. And so you'll have black specks start to come to the surface, which is extruded hemoglobin that you've pushed out of the capillaries, which is then oxidized. So there may be a disease there. And there are a whole lot of people who have probably given themselves something that looks enough like it that they're now convinced they have it. And of course, the power of the mind is great and the power of focus is great. And I will say that it is credible enough as an existing entity that the National Institute for Health is actually trying to figure out if there is such a thing as Morgellons. So it's being taken at least that seriously. But it may be the first of several diseases that are sort of internet diseases. And a natural phenomenon that's reconstrued as a disease. And then because of its self-perpetuating nature and, like I said, the toxic meme quality of it, we're actually getting people giving themselves this thing once they read about it or hear about it. So GMO foods scare me too. I mean, the whole idea that they're going in and messing with the DNA, and yes, of course, we know what we're doing. Yeah, well, we've all heard that before. And I just pray that they do know what they're doing. And I'm not sure they do, but the genie is out of the bottle. So all I can do as a consumer is avoid genetically modified foods as much as possible. And I'll give you another reason to avoid them, which is that the more various your diet, the less likely you are when you're under stress to develop food sensitivities. And as far as I'm concerned, our entire society is under stress, except maybe for the people up there at the land of Medicine Buddha or something who meditate for 2 hours a day, and they're probably fine.
Yeah.
But the rest of us are already just battered with interruptions and psychological toxins all the time. And on top of that, a diet that is monotonous in terms of the molecules that you consume is just a setup to develop food sensitivities. And I really do think that we're being poisoned not so much by the GMO as by our environment, and the GMOs, because they're so monotonous in terms of their molecules, they're giving our body something to react against. So it's much more of a complex dynamic than this is a bad food and directly toxic. It's sort of indirectly toxic. You see what I'm saying?
Yes. And if you do have time, and I will take it off the air, I just heard you made a comment about the corn, and I have a hard time finding things without corn. You've got to read the labels really careful. But if you can talk maybe, if you do have time, like I said, a minute or two about corn and how to avoid corn and how to look for non-GMO corn in products, because I think there's a massive problem with labeling laws in the country as well. And there's several examples of that. But
right.
If you have time, I will really appreciate that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
Bye. I'll just take a moment and share my strategy, which is expensive. You pretty much have to buy your food at the health food stores and look very carefully at the labels, even so. And a lot of packages do contain enough information. But if you see the word corn and it isn't qualified as, you know, no GMO products, then you're pretty much going to assume that this is a genetically modified entity, because even corn that isn't labeled can be. And that has to do with the fact that pollen's carried on the wind. It's really funny. So even though Monsanto would love to capture all that pollen so that their proprietary genetics couldn't get loose, it does get loose. And in fact, that's a good objection to the whole concept. It will contaminate the natural food supply. It has contaminated the natural food supply. You know, how do you prove it's not GMO? And the labeling laws stink. They're better in Europe, but the criteria for calling something organic in this country is such that many, many organic foods go unlabeled because there's too much bureaucracy involved in getting the piece of paper that allows you to call it organic. We really need to reform our food labeling process. Don't hold your breath. Essentially, you need to avoid things that contain the word corn. If it says corn solids or corn syrup, it still probably has enough corn protein in it that you could react if you're sensitive or become sensitized. And you aren't going to be able to eliminate it entirely very readily. So what you do is you seek to reduce it, and you seek not to consume corn-containing products. If you're going to consume them at all, not to consume them daily. And I think that's really key. If you know where they are and you don't eat them daily, you've reduced your chances of having a problem, directly reduced it. Let's go to Tom in Salinas. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. It's so nice to talk to you. I love hearing your show and all the education you give out there.
Thank you.
I'm a nurse, and I'm working on an advanced directive project for the county.
Oh, good.
And it's not going well. Only about somewhere between 1% and 10% of people have one, and most of the time it's done through an attorney, and it's not in the doctor's chart or the hospital chart. And getting people to understand and know what they are and how to use them is a difficult process.
First of all, let's define an advance directive. It's a document that someone executes when they're well and mentally sound that says, in the event that I am, whatever, let's say I have a stroke and I'm paralyzed in a nursing home and I get pneumonia, I don't want you to treat my pneumonia. Or you could simply say, I don't want to have my heart shocked back if my heart stops beating. And if you're 80 years old and your heart stops beating, the chances that you will be gotten back are well under 5%. And if you are gotten back, the chances that you'll be gotten back neurologically intact are, you know, less than 1%. So it's a reasonable thing at a certain age to say, you know what, if it's my time, it's my time. Let's not give me a painful death with a 1% shot that you're going to actually get me back. With odds like that, I think very rational. A person who has cancer may go further. They may say, I don't want, you know, artificial feeding, I don't want any IV tubes, I don't want to, you know, anything, because this is going to kill me anyway, and I'd rather die fast than die slow. So all of those options are available in a good advanced directive, and a person can modify them as their life situation changes. I have an advanced directive. My husband has one. My parents have one. Because when I was in residency, I did exactly this project that you're doing. And I learned some interesting things after doing that project when I finally got out into the real world. I learned that it's very hard to talk to people about the fact that they might die. And I have to figure out when to do it. So as a doctor, I usually do it when I do the annual physical. And I say something along the lines of, well, you're great. I can't find anything wrong with you. Or aside from X, Y, and Z, I can't find anything wrong with you. We handle X, Y, and Z. And then I say, so do you have an advance directive? Do you have one of these documents? Explain what it is. And if they don't, I give them a copy of it and ask them to fill it out and give it back to me, and I'll scan it into their chart. When a person goes into the hospital for any reason, they get the same question. But oddly enough, the law prevents you from executing one of those while you're in the hospital. So you have to get out of the hospital to execute one. And the hospitals do also keep them on file. If you were going to do something useful, you would figure out a way to get the patients not to freak out when the doctor asks them if they have an advance directive, not to assume that the doctor thinks they're going to have a cardiac arrest and therefore is asking them this question because I know something that you don't know, because I can't ask this question easily to people when they're coming into the hospital and they're sick because it scares them to death. I have to ask them if they have one, but I don't really try to educate them about it unless, well, certain circumstances I will, because it scares them. And we need to figure out how to get past that barrier of not wanting to scare the patient or make the patient uncomfortable, which doctors face.
Yeah, that's my point exactly. You have to start planting these seeds of talking about dying with dignity earlier so that the conversation becomes more comfortable. I mean, like your show, the focus is on staying well, but we're all going to die, and hopefully with some dignity and getting this conversation going early, because there's a lot to think about, the resuscitate or don't resuscitate, but it depends in the middle. And talking about this with your family and getting everyone on board so that they know your wishes is an important thing if you want to maintain some kind of dignity.
Well, I think I agree with you completely. I think it's extremely important. An interesting focus for your project might be how to get that to happen, or what strategies have different programs across the country used that have been successful in diffusing this topic. Is it something that we send the grandchildren home on Thanksgiving with a five wishes form? Would that work? Is it possible to get people to talk about a subject, that is to say death, that they most commonly just confront with denial? And if
right.
So, how?
I'm trying to approach this. This is a gift you can give your children or whoever to avoid problems at a stressful time. It's something that's going to create more comfort in the end than stress. But getting over that hump and getting it actually done is another story. It's very difficult. In the office, people don't want to spend time with it because they're not going to get reimbursed. And maybe coding and other education might be one way, but you're rushed getting people through, and it's something you always put further on down the line.
Yeah, and the other thing is the follow-through. I would like to see something that is outside of the doctor's office, really, because that's a point where we do want to be emphasizing health and wellness. And I always talk to my patients about it, but I don't see the follow through and I don't track it. How many of those forms that I give out do I ever get back? But I would have to say way less than 50%. Just seated the pants.
Well, you're one of the few physicians that are talking about it.
Well, yeah, I know, but that's because I did that project back 20 years ago. And so,
okay.
You know, I've always had a sense of awareness. I had a patient, we all knew was going to die. She had throat cancer and eventually her airway was going to close off. And she had an advance directive, but it was before things were sort of officially encoded and before there were any mechanisms for people to come in and have that available at the hospital. And it was one of those hospitals that was not the one locally. This was down in Southern California, but it was a religious hospital. And the doctor on duty that night was a religious person who felt very strongly that everything should be done. So this woman who had expressly not wanted to be intubated was tubed. And once you put that tube in, then you have to get her and the family's permission to pull it. And God got involved and the chaplain got involved and family members came out of the woodwork who'd not had the conversations that the immediate family had, and it was a mess, and there was really nothing that could be done to salvage the situation. And I felt that I had failed my patient, and that's what got me involved in this in the first place.
I run into that a lot where people have them, but you know, they're at the attorney's office.
Exactly, and you really need a copy. Well, ideally what you have is you have a PDF or some other form of readily readable file on your keychain, on one of those little disky things. I forget what, I'm blanking on what they're called now, but those little mini discs that people carry on their key rings now. And that would be great. There it is. You'd plug it into the hospital computer and print it out, and it's on the files. So that would be a great thing for children to do for their parents, is give them a little key fob.
Oh, that's a good idea.
You could even put like your drug list and your medical history on there. Gosh, how long ago was it? 1992, when Clinton was talking about everybody having a smart card that would not only have their health insurance information, but also some medical data that would make it ever so much easier to take care of them. In 19 years later, we're still in the dark ages when it comes to leveraging our technology. I don't know what's up with this.
Well, thank you for letting me help get the word out.
Thank you very much for your call. Bye-bye. And let's go now to Dan in Aramis. Hello, Dan, and welcome to the program.
Hey, I talked to you about a year ago. I was diagnosed with follicular lymphoma in 2009 of May. I was at my general practitioner, and they found it, and it was about the size of a softball. It was a, a tumor in my abdomen.
Softball.
So I went through two series once a week for 4 weeks of Rituxan therapy. They call it chemotherapy, but it's actually antibody therapy. And the tumor shrunk and grew back and shrunk and grew back a little bit. And at that time, I called you, and you suggested to try wheatgrass juice. And I have spent the last year taking wheatgrass juice twice a day. I built up to it slowly, 4 ounces in the morning and 4 ounces in the afternoon, along with the diet and the exercise. And recently went in for a PET scan, and the tumor now has shrunk to a quarter of the size of what it was.
So, that's great news.
Yeah, it's going the right direction. The oncologist says, well, it's Rituxan doing its job. And, well, you know, I can't say. You know, I haven't had any Rituxan.
Well, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be an either-or, okay?
Correct.
Like the concept that I like to use, I learned this recently, is that what it is fertile soil, or a permissive environment was the phrase that was used at the lectures I attended last year for functional medicine on cancer as a chronic disease. And the idea is that you eat a lot of junk, you're full of stress, you don't sleep well, you're a fertile ground for something to get a good foothold because your immune system is suppressed.
Sure.
So if you want to not get cancer, you have to treat yourself right so that your immune system is able to be vigilant and defeat any cancers that you get, because you are going to get cancers. The really scary thing is that we all have mutations in our body that are one step away, or cells that are one step away from being cancer. And if you go looking for microscopic cancers that are not yet spread and have not yet grown, but are essentially cells that are biologically mutated enough to be cancer cells, microtumors they're called, you'll find them in anybody. You'll find them in males in the prostate. You'll find them in females in the breast. And they don't become cancer. We don't all die of cancer. And the reason is because these cells are looking pretty darn dissident, pretty subversive, and the immune system kills them off before they have a chance to take off and start dividing, lose all of the controls on their growth. And this is a push-pull dynamic that's constantly at work, and we can push harder against cancer by making ourselves less permissive environment. And things like the wheatgrass, juicing in general, organic fruits and vegetables, meditation, stress reduction, all of these things that have been shown to improve immunity will help with the fight against cancer. One of the most ironic things in the world is that our oncologists are not taking advantage of all of this information we have about how good these dietary antioxidants are for cancer. Instead, they're telling people, don't take any vitamins, don't do any juicing, don't do these things because you might interfere with your chemotherapy. Did you hear that from your oncologist?
No, quite the opposite.
Good.
open to alternatives, and he doesn't sway a person one way or the other. But he's
what's his name? What's his name?
Well, I don't know if I want to say that over here.
No, please do. I mean, I don't think you're doing anything bad for his practice if you recommend him.
His name's Dr. Wu. He's in SoCal there at the Palo Alto Medical Foundation.
All right. Well, hooray for Dr. Wu and having an open mind. So
I will say that, you know, all the folks over there, the nurses and the doctors, are a great bunch, and I'm happy they're there, and maybe someday I'll need them in the future for... I continue to see him, you know, annually or semi-annually. And
right.
So, great and bunch of folks.
What we did with AIDS is we took AIDS from being a lethal disease to a chronic disease, and we did that in 25 years. And I hope that's what we'll do with cancer.
We're working on it.
But in your case, effectively, you were in a situation where you were able to use a monoclonal antibody drug. By the way, Rituxan is a monoclonal antibody. It comes from mice, and it's an antibody against a protein, a surface protein called CD20, and that's on the surface of beta cells, so it can destroy beta cells, which effectively lymphoma is a beta cell cancer. So it's a useful drug. It's expensive, and one of the reasons we'd like not to have cancers is because these monoclonal antibodies are quite expensive. This one...
It was about $80,000 for the two series of treatments, versus a little over $100 and a lot of labor on my part for the wheatgrass.
Enough said. Thank you very much for the follow-up call.
I had one question.
Sure.
If you're familiar with a new blood test that's come out, and I guess it's effective for certain types of cancers, maybe not my type, but I'm curious. It's an alternative to PET scans or CAT scans. It's somehow it filters cancer cells.
It's the circulating blood cells. The technology actually has been around in Europe for a couple of years, and recently somebody came out with a commercial product, which I think I covered about a month ago. If you go back in the archives and just look for the topics, you'll find a discussion of it, of
what
that specific company.
It?
I can't remember the name of the company, but it'll be described. My encyclopedic memory does not extend to remembering the name of the company that...
No excuses necessary.
Anyway, but the idea here is that you filter blood, you see the number of circulating tumor cells. And as I was saying before, with cancers, there's a series of stepwise mutations. And so the tumors will lose their ability to adhere, their stickiness, and start to drop off into the bloodstream and into the lymphatics where they can be picked up. And sometimes they can be picked up even before the person is known to have a cancer. And that's the holy grail, is run a blood test, find cancer cells from the prostate and say, okay, well, you've got prostate cancer. Now we're going to go find it. But we're not there yet. What it is being used for in Europe, and I think it's an extremely good use, and I'd like to see it done here more readily, is it's being used to screen your tumor cells for sensitivity to various chemotherapies because there's chemo resistance. So if you have chemo-resistant tumor cells, then you would choose a different chemo. And that could be a real breakthrough. And it hasn't been fully validated, and it's not in the interests of the pharmaceutical industry for it to be validated. Somebody will figure out how to make it profitable, and then we'll see it. But at the moment, it's really you have to send your blood to Europe to get this information. There are a couple of labs in the country that will transship your blood, by the way, but I'm not going to go into any commercial advocacy because I'm just not sure that the technology is there yet. But it is being done. I hope that we will have that screening tool soon.
Sounds like a great thing to... A useful tool.
It would be wonderful. It would be wonderful. The way it works is there are certain genes that are turned on in cancer cells that are not turned on in adult somatic cells. They're basically embryological genes that are turned on in tumor cells. Shouldn't be turned on in an adult, so when you find those genes, it's like, oop, that's from a tumor cell.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time.
I appreciate your call.
Have a great show. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And what great story. Isn't that wonderful? Makes me proud. I would like to talk to Mo in, it's a little recursive, we'll talk to Mo in Scotts Valley. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Wow, those last two callers, how interesting. Amazing.
Indeed.
Wow. Well, first I wanted to thank you for your service to the community. I mean, it's just wonderful. I have a friend that just had a mini stroke on Tuesday. He was in Dominican emergency room. He's had hypertension. He's been seeing a doctor for like a year and a half. And he's on Acupril,
yes.
20 milligrams a day. He has another friend that wants to help him out by, you know, supplementing with herbs and things. And I just wanted to check to see if there was anything that was that could counteract, you know, that would be good for him to take as far as his medicine.
Okay, so let me...
He was thinking Gota Cola, of course, fish oil, so we know that one's okay.
Right.
But do you know anything about the Gota Cola? I know what Gota Cola is, but I don't know if it has any reactions with that particular pharmaceutical.
No, it doesn't, except that it can raise blood pressure. And
oh,
so
really?
If he's using it for lowering blood pressure, then you have to be careful. It won't necessarily at the doses he's using, but you have to watch for that effect. The other things that need to be avoided are anything that contains extra potassium. Acupril will cause a little bit of retention of potassium, which is not a problem unless the person is taking potassium supplements of some kind.
Okay.
And then they could actually get toxic on the potassium.
Okay. Well, I think he's just taking a regular multiple. I don't know that what things would have extra potassium.
Well, a lot of things that are designed to lower blood pressure might have extra potassium. There's a salt substitute, potassium chloride, that people can buy just over the counter that use instead of salt, and they might have been told by the doctor to avoid salt, so they go get potassium, which by itself, by the way, potassium and magnesium lower blood pressure. But if you're on Acupril, because of the potassium retention issue, you don't want to take extra potassium.
Okay. Is there anything else he can do? He's, you know, it's his right side that's impaired right now. And can you think of any other things, like should he be taking CoQ10 for circulation?
Now, he had a mini stroke, you said, a TIA?
I think they were calling it a stroke.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
yeah.
I'm looking at his discharge papers, and it says something R10 stroke. I can't read it. And I don't know if that makes any sense.
Well, you know, doctor's handwriting's hard enough when you're looking at it.
Exactly.
Terms of over the radio, no, sorry. We're out of luck on that.
Right, okay. They did say he had a stroke.
Maybe
a
hypertensive stroke if he was put on Acupril. And
well, he was on Acupril prior to this.
All right, so we aren't going to figure this out. So what else do you want to do? You want to watch out for ginkgo, which a lot of people take for mental things. That would be a no-no. Ginseng can raise blood pressure in some people. It's in a lot of tonics, so you kind of have to watch. Maybe I take those away. Anything that's got a caffeine energy type component, guarana would probably be a no-no. That's in some energy drinks.
Okay, so he shouldn't be drinking any caffeine then?
The data on caffeine is mixed, and, you know, that's the problem.
Yeah.
A lot of the data is mixed. But in general, I try to lower people's sympathetic tone, and caffeine raises it, so I figure, you know, cut back on the caffeine, not a bad idea. It also is difficult for your body to detoxify, and it upregulates certain enzymes that make nitrosamines and other carcinogenic things found in diet more readily available to do their damage. So why go there?
Right, exactly.
Why go there? The other things I would say, okay, natokinase, which can be helpful because it reduces fibrin. So it's never been shown scientifically to reduce stroke, but it's one of those herbs that is in the it won't hurt, might help kind of category.
Yeah, you know, he did the, I think it's Dr. Sinatra's book that had all those alternative things. He tried all that stuff, and he says, you know, it didn't lower his blood pressure.
Right.
So I don't know.
Well, the Sinatra protocol doesn't work for everybody, and it doesn't necessarily make you feel any different even when it is working.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to lower blood pressure and your blood pressure doesn't drop, you might still be getting some health benefits from it. It's hard to disprove.
Okay. So you're saying that the natokinase, he should still take that?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think there's enough soft data, and there's a good plausible physiologic mechanism, and there's no downside.
And anything else that you can think of, like
high-dose fish oil, we already talked about that, right?
And so his dose should be higher than what you normally recommend?
Yeah, if you're using it to reduce blood pressure, you want your EPA component alone to be about 2,000 milligrams.
Oh, wow.
Okay. So we're talking a lot of fish oil here.
Okay. And the DHA?
Less important, because if you go that high on the EPA, the DHA will follow. Your body will convert the EPA readily into DHA. It just doesn't convert DHA back into EPA that easily.
Okay. So that would be a daily dose, 2,000 milligrams.
Yeah. And that's a high dose. And
and
if he's on Coumadin or a blood thinner, that may be too much. I mean, you'll have to watch for interactions there.
And you recommend the Costco brand of the fish oils? Would that work?
Well, I wouldn't say I recommend it. The best brands are, I think, the Nordic Naturals and the Metagenics brands. the Costco brand is much more cost effective.
Right.
It's cheaper.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's bad.
Okay. You said you had it, it was tested through...
Right. It was tested through Consumer Lab, and it was found to have not to be, have antioxidant toxicity issues, contamination, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. And then as far as diet, should he be eating like higher protein foods right now, or would that be not good?
Is he overweight?
No.
Okay. I like a high protein diet for elders as long as they have good kidney functioning.
He's only 56.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I missed the age. Yes, I'd recommend a high-protein diet with perhaps 30% of calories from protein, but lean protein and,
right.
and lots of that vegetable protein.
Yeah, he has a tendency to eat a lot of carbs. So.
Yeah, and you know, if you've listened to the show at all, you've heard me on carbs.
Right, so. Exactly. But he's not overweight, you know, and I don't think he's not diabetic or anything. Okay, anything else that you could think of that would be helpful?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay, great. No, that's wonderful. So that helps. I will inform him.
Yeah, one thing on the rehab end of things.
Yes.
When was the stroke?
We think it was Monday, but he didn't get to the emergency room until Tuesday.
Okay. So the next 3 months are critical. And
okay.
if his right side is weak, there's
yes.
a tendency to try to train the left hand to do stuff that the right hand was doing.
Yes.
That's understandable, but your best thing is to use that right hand as much as possible.
Okay.
So... literally, even just having someone lift the right arm and move it back and forth to brush his teeth like a puppet
okay.
will help retrain the neurological circuitry.
Okay.
And hours and hours and hours a day of trying to use that arm, really forcing yourself to do something with it, whatever you can do,
okay.
will revive the neurologic circuitry at the point where it's at its greatest plasticity. Because the first 3 months after a stroke is when you can... get a natural adaptation going on in the brain. The brain wants to rewire
okay.
itself. And if you're doing the movements, even thinking the movements, visualizing them mentally, will actually encourage the rewiring process. And they've done really intensive rehab where they took people a year after a stroke and worked them 8 hours a day, 7 days a week. They had to do it every day. And they were able to get this kind of rewiring to happen very late. But if you do it right away, it doesn't require nearly that much labor input.
Okay. And how about walking?
Absolutely.
He should walk.
As much as possible. And initially, if he needs an assistive device, use it. You know, don't not walk because you don't want to be an old man with a walker. That
right.
is
right.
that is self-defeating and foolish.
Exactly. And then what are, I know each case is different, but what is the likelihood or what is the percentage of him having another one?
I can't tell you that without
yeah.
knowing more about his clinical situation
yeah.
and specifically what type of stroke he had, but pretty good,
yeah.
pretty high,
okay.
and that's why steps need to be taken to reduce his risk and turn him, just as we did with the cancer patient discussion, from fertile territory for another stroke into a non-permissive place for another stroke to occur.
Okay.
All right, good luck to
Great.
You.
Great. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. One other reason to eat a lot of protein and reduce the carbohydrates is that when people have a high carbohydrate diet and they have higher insulin, they get fat depositing in their visceral tissue, and that fat elaborates a number of hormones. One of them is a anti-tissue plasminogen activator. So in other words, it prolongs the duration that a clot will be in your body. And another compound, PAI, one inhibitor, is actually an inhibitor of a platelet-activating inhibitor. So again, a compound which makes it more likely that the blood will clot. And that's what many strokes are, is a clot. So we have time to take one of the stories that I had prepared for us. I want to comment a little bit, taking up the thread that we had earlier this show about social engineering, and to do some commentary on what's going on here in California. I had a patient come into my office yesterday, and it was the first time I had seen it, but she had a application for the California pre-existing insurance plan, and she was applying for this and was going to get health insurance under this plan. I haven't seen anything in the news. I have no idea how we activate the California pre-existing insurance plan, so if there's anyone out there who's done it, please call this show or next week and tell us how you found that out, and I'll do some research and try to have that. There are 600,000 people in California who have to buy individual health insurance, and They are generally individuals who have something wrong with them, which is why they spring for individual health insurance. They don't get it at work, in other words. The health plans were going to do an up to 60% hike on the insurance rates for people who buy these plans. And the California Insurance Commissioner was able to get at least three of the companies, apparently this is voluntary on their part, to agree to hold off on the rate increases for 60 days to give Dave Jones, the insurance commissioner, a chance to review the delays, the rate filings, and check their math. Because would you be surprised to learn that there are math errors in the favor of insurance companies in the filings that they give to the state of California? And if you don't check their math, you know, they may not have the justification for those rate increases. Now, the good guys, Aetna, Anthem Blue Cross, and Pacific Care are good guys. They actually graciously agreed to wait and let the insurance commissioner check their math. Blue Shield said, nah, we're going to go ahead and raise the rates. And then the last little bit of news on that is that California does actually lead the nation in this high risk pool management and also in going out and trying to figure out how we're going to deal with the new influx, up to 2 million people who will be able to enroll in Medi-Cal in 2014. And I think it's going to prove very difficult to dismantle the benefits once they are initiated. So all we need to do is fight a holding action in Congress and wait for 2012 to roll around, and then this beast is going to have some momentum. Let's talk to Mary in Watsonville. Hello, Mary, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I love your nutrition information. When I'm reading labels, you're sitting on my shoulder.
Oh, good. I hope I'm sitting on the good angel side.
Yes. What would Dr. Don say? I have actually a quick question and a longer one. The quick one is, I'm a teacher, and my students, so many of them have been sick with colds and flu. I haven't gotten sick yet this year, and I'm wondering if it's because in the fall, my doctor said, oh, you haven't had a tetanus booster here. You'll get that and something else. And I guess it was the pertussis one,
uh-huh.
which my insurance didn't cover. Isn't that interesting?
You'd think, they don't care if you cough until you puke for 2 months.
Well, yeah, you'd think the school district would. Anyway, I wonder if that had anything to do with me not just catching my regular nasty winter cold.
Well, I don't know. It's possible that it did, and it's possible that it was just a good coincidence. We've had a warmer winter. We had those freezes back in the usual time, you know, January and late December. But in general, it's been a warmer winter, and the flu and cold viruses really like it to be cold to transmit. So they hang around better in a cold space. That's part of it. Another part of it is you open the windows when it's warmer, and that helps because you blow the viruses out the window. The surfaces are, you know, the thing that is still an issue, and maybe you're doing a little bit better about hand washing or hand sanitation. There's been a real concerted effort to get people to use those hand sterilizers, and I don't know if your utilization of that has changed, but
well, you
other
know,
people's
I have
may have.
Regular baby wipes. I have them behind my desk, and I use those a lot. They're not, I don't know if they're how antibacterial they are, but at least they get my hands clean.
I'm not sure either on that one, but my point is that if other people's practices change, then there are fewer vectors out there to expose you.
Right.
Although as a teacher, you're getting exposed. How long have you been a teacher?
14 years.
All right, so it's not just the new teacher finally getting immunity effect.
Oh, no, I had that in the beginning.
Yeah. Flu shots have been shown to reduce your risk of getting colds, and no one understands that.
Yeah, I also have a flu shot. My other question is, my mom turned 100 last year,
Oh. And
she's super healthy. And when she's not doing good things for other people, she watches TV, and then she tells me all these things that she hears on TV. And one of them is that I have one of my best friends is Miss Matilda, my cat that I've had for 2 years. And she's telling me, she heard on TV that if you have a cat in the house that you can get this and that disease from cats. And I just wanted to get your feedback on the possibility of getting illnesses or diseases from cats.
There are a couple of diseases that you can get from house cats fairly commonly. I'm sure there's rare ones, but the big two are toxoplasmosis and Pastorella multicida. And so I'll start with toxoplasmosis. It's a parasite. The cats poop it out. It's in the cat box dust. For example, if women are pregnant and there's a cat box in the house, they're encouraged to wear a mask, like an N95 mask, when they change the kitty litter or delegate that to someone else. Toxoplasmosis can cause birth defects in a fetus. And so that's just one of those 100 little details that are out there and things you're supposed to remember to tell people when you're doing OB care. Now, the other one, Pastorella multiseta, is in cats' mouths. So it's not cat scratches, but cat bites that will become very rapidly infected. And that's the hallmark of this disease. It's extremely fast. So typical staph infection, I get scratched and a day or two later, it starts to get red and sore. With Pastorella, it's 6 to 12 hours and the thing is red and sore and swollen. And so when I see that rapid infection, I know I can treat with just penicillin rather than going to one of the more complex broad-spectrum antibiotics. The last one is cat scratch fever, made famous by an old rock singer, Ted Nugent, although these many years. That's actually quite rare. It is an ascending lymphadenitis, and so people get a red streak, and then the lymph nodes on their elbow and underarm, or wherever the proximal lymph nodes are from that injury, will swell up, and that does respond to antibiotics.
Okay.
So I don't think you need to worry about Miss Matilda.
Well, good, because she's a very happy lady, rescued one day before execution from the shelter, put in a good word for the SPCA. Just a wonderful friend, and I think she is lowering my blood pressure.
I'm sure she is, and she's probably going to prolong your life. They say that cats and dogs, pets, that is, do that and also reduce the incidence of depression. So it's all good.
Okay, I will tell my mom that.
It's worth a few flea bites. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And a quick story, just before we come to the end of the hour. If you're given antibiotics for anything, you should avoid that antibiotic for the next year. Recent research shows that you will have resistant bacteria in your system to whatever antibiotic you were taking. And the incidence at 1 month is way over 50% of people will have bacteria that are antibiotic resistant to whatever they just took. At 12 months, there's still a small percentage of residual resistance. So vary your antibiotics, folks. New principle, old idea. We've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.